Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The affirmative action policies were established in this country in the 1960s to give more equal footing to minority candidates in education and the job market and to establish the education benefits associated with diversity. The most recent affirmative action case was decided by the Supreme Court last Monday after an eight-month deliberation in Fisher versus the University of Texas. Here to discuss the case right now is Ruth Kolker. She's a professor and constitutional law expert at the OSU Moritz College of Law. It should be noted that she is not speaking for the College of Law and its diversity policies today. Welcome to the show, Ruth.
Well, thanks for having me, Ann.
Okay, so Abigail Fisher brought this suit in 2008. The case was heard 8 months ago. That's not that long to wait. And the U.S. Supreme Court announced its decision on June 24th. In its decision, the court reaffirmed the educational benefits of diversity, but what constitutes diversity and how it is achieved is less clear. The ruling was almost a non-decision rather than a decision, but both sides are claiming victory. What?
Well, I guess there's a lot in it for everybody. It was a 7-1 decision. When was the last time we saw that kind of lineup on something as controversial as affirmative action? So that meant you should expect a lot of ambiguity, right, because you're not going to get a clear statement from seven members of the court. And it's going to leave a lot open for the future. But there are some, you know, really important nuggets that I'm sure university officials are going to be looking at closely to make sure that their own plans are constitutional.
The New York Times predicted a wave of challenges to race conscious admissions policies nationwide. What would those challenges consist of?
Well, certainly because the court did not merely affirm what the University of Texas did, so there's still some uncertainty as to whether their plan is constitutional, that would lead some people to think that this area is ripe for further challenges, and there's some strong language in the court's opinion about how courts should consider those challenges, and that language is arguably a little tighter in terms of what universities can do than we had seen from the Grutter opinion just in 2003. And so one could argue that now, a decade after Grutter, the court has tightened up a little bit, narrowed a little bit the ways in which universities can engage in affirmative action, and that certainly could lead people to make further challenges, to think that the university's policies are unconstitutional.
Since the Grutter ruling in 2003, have universities, do we know much about how they've gone out on their own to change things? And because so many of them are okay with what the ruling was last Monday.
Well, I know that every university in the country that has an affirmative action plan read Grutter extremely closely and tried to make sure that their policy modeled the policy used by the University of Michigan Law School, but did not model the program struck down by the court in the Gratz case on the same day that reflected what the undergraduate admissions had done at the University of Michigan. So there has been a lot of writing about what was it that the University of Michigan Law School did that was on the constitutional side of the ledger, and you would obviously, as a university, want to be on that side of the ledger.
What was the argument made about the educational benefit of diversity?
Well, in Grutter, the University of Michigan Law School argued strenuously that diversity is extremely important, that you need to have what's called a critical mass of students of varied backgrounds in the classroom to have an appropriate, vigorous academic environment. We don't want to have a token, you know, one African-American student in a law school class of 200. You know, we want to have a critical mass so that everybody can see that there's actually diversity within that group itself, right? We wouldn't expect that one African-American to speak for all African-Americans. So the court in Grutter endorsed this concept that universities were entitled to seek to have a critical mass in their programs. In the Texas case, in the Fisher case, the court continued to say that universities, if they chose, and not required to, but if they chose, if they thought that their university was a more vibrant place because of that critical mass, they could choose to seek to use constitutional policies to achieve that critical mass. So the university in Grutter, and now again in Fisher, is allowed to articulate as a compelling state interest this interest in having a diverse student body.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the ruling last week by the U.S. Supreme Court in Fisher versus the University of Texas. Still with me is Ruth Kolker, professor, constitutional expert at OSU Moritz College of Law. How is this case related? You've mentioned Grutter now and Gratz, related to previous affirmative action cases. Was there a step from Grutter to this?
There's always steps, that's right. This is a complicated step. In some ways, I think the most complicated step, and if you don't mind, let me explain why that is. In Grutter, the Supreme Court, with a 5-4 decision authored by Justice O'Connor, who's no longer on the court, concluded that the University of Michigan's law school's affirmative action policy, diversity policy, was constitutional. At that time, Justice Kennedy was on the court. He dissented, and he authored a dissent in which he explained why it was that, in his opinion, the University of Michigan Law School's program was not constitutional. Now, in the Fisher case, the opinion that Justice Kennedy wrote for the court assumes that Grutter is still good law. The court doesn't decide that issue, but assumes that Grutter is still good law. He then says, and this is what Grutter meant in terms of what it means as a legal principle. But when he said, what does Grutter mean? The opinion he really relied on was his own. That was actually a dissenting opinion. And he draws from his dissenting opinion to say, this is what Grutter really means. And there's two really important principles he draws from Grutter. And those are the two important principles that will be considered on remand. So it's sort of a step sideways, a step, if you are a university, maybe you would consider backwards, because you were probably, as a university official, drawing on the majority language from Grutter, not the dissenting language. But now there are not 5 members of the court that would apparently join the language that Justice O'Connor used for a majority of the court in Grutter. So Grutter has been sort of re-understood when Justice Kennedy gets to author the opinion for the court in Fisher.
If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. This issue of determining educational benefit, is it a qualitative measure or is it a quantitative? How have the lower courts been directed to make that determination?
Well, that's actually not the hard determination right now. The Supreme Court has told us now twice that if a university wants to articulate that it has a compelling state interest in seeking to enroll a diverse student body, it is allowed to do that. The hard issue that remains, which will be decided on remand, is what are the means that a university is allowed to use to achieve that diverse student body. So really, our focus right now has moved away from can they articulate this compelling state interest in diversity, which was a huge issue in Grutter, huge issue. And you remember there are all these amicus briefs from the U.S. military and Fortune 500 companies saying, we need a diverse student body because we need a diverse workforce. Mm-hmm. Okay, that battle is sort of over because Justice Kennedy is conceding, I think, it'd be fair to say, that that is a compelling state interest. The court has sort of taken that step now a couple of times. But the battle remains with what are the means that the university may use to achieve that compelling state interest. And that's where I'm sure that university officials are scratching their head, reading extremely closely what the University of Michigan Law School did, what the University of Texas is doing for undergraduate admissions, and asking themselves, is our program on the constitutional side of the ledger?
And when we're talking about diversity, we're not just talking about African Americans versus or black versus white.
No, that's right. When the court is extremely clear that when we're talking about diversity, we're talking about a very, very broad range of factors, factors such as your socioeconomic status, your extracurricular activities. Are you an athlete? Some universities will consider whether you're a legacy admit, whether you have a family member who went to the university. Do you play the trombone? Do you dance? Many, many aspects of a person's life. Race would only be one factor among many. That's been true since the Supreme Court's decision in Bakke in 1978. So in 1978, Justice Powell wrote a concurrence for the court But that concurrence that no one joined but him, he was the only person who articulated that opinion has become really the sort of gold standard for what diversity means, that it has to be a broad program that considers many, many elements, and race would be one element among many.
And, all right, so how do they prove that? How do they prove that, that what their process is?
What means they're using.
Right.
Right. Well, that's obviously another difficult piece of this puzzle. In the University of Michigan case, the Grutter case, that case went to trial. And at trial, there was testimony from admissions officers and others who testified exactly how that process worked. In the University of Texas case, that case was decided by the district court on what we call summary judgment, which means there has not been a trial. There were facts that were demonstrated through affidavits and depositions and the like, but there has not been a trial. There's not been anyone who sat and was examined and cross-examined by an attorney. And so one of the things Justice Kennedy emphasized in his opinion for the court is this is a summary judgment case, and so you have to it's a sort of a stronger standard for establishing facts when no one actually testified and the judge didn't get to observe people's demeanor to see if they seem honest or not. So at this point, we know the case has been remanded back to the Fifth Circuit. The Fifth Circuit will have to decide whether this was a case appropriate for summary judgment or should this case now go back to the trial court and have a full-fledged trial on exactly what were the fine details of the University of Texas's admissions process.
Back in 2008.
In 2008, right. I hope people had some good notes and some good memories. That's right.
All right. We're going to continue our conversation about the U.S. Supreme Court ruling on race-based or diversity admissions policies in higher education in the United States, of course, when we return with Ruth Kolker, constitutional law professor at OSU Moritz College of Law, and coming up. We'll have somebody who studies racial equality in higher education. So stay with us. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
What's missing between Morning Edition and All Things Considered?
Could it be a comprehensive program of news, analysis, and features in the middle of your day?
That's it.
I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. And now NPR is combining resources with public radio stations all across the country for Here and Now.
Smart journalists taking you to places you've never been.
With stories that are significant, heartfelt, enlightening.
Starting today.
Here and Now.
Don't miss a thing.
This afternoon from 2 till 4 on 89.7 NPR News.
Support comes from the Homeport Noble on Long Condominiums, offering home ownership opportunities in the King Lincoln District, featuring a diverse community with a mix of historic and newly built homes and condos. Details at homeportohio.org/NOBO on Long.
You're listening to 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station. We bring you NPR news every morning and evening, 7 days a week.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the U.S. Supreme Court's decision last week regarding diversity in campus race-based admissions policies in light of the recent ruling in Fisher versus the University of Texas. In his majority opinion, Justice Anthony Kennedy wrote that courts reviewing affirmative action programs must show that it is necessary to use race to achieve the educational benefits of diversity. Joining us now to further define those notions, I hope, is Estella Ben-Simon, who studies racial equality in higher ed at the University of Southern California, and she joins us from there. Welcome to the show, Estella.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
What do we mean by diversity, and has that idea changed over time?
Well, I think that the notion of diversity came about after the University of Michigan case. Mm-hmm. Because the court, as your previous guest described, determined that diversity was a compelling interest, and therefore universities could use race as a plus factor. But before the Bakke case, actually, the purposes of affirmative action were not so much about diversity, but they were about equity in access to higher education, in particular for previously excluded populations. The diversity is a term that came about after, particularly after the Grutter decision, in that we're justifying the use of race not to remedy past wrongs, but in order to achieve a racially as well as gender diverse student body.
Are diversity policies something that vary from campus to campus? Does there tend to be a lot of differences across the country?
Well, you know, diversity in highly selective institutions like mine, it means something different than in the institutions like, for instance, the California State University system, whereas at USC or the University of California, which is the public research university, students who are African-American and who are Latinos are fairly underrepresented. And so diversity there means increasing their numbers. In the California State University system, for the most campuses, the issue of diversity is not a problem. We have institutions that have been designated as Hispanic-serving, as well as some that are predominantly non-white institutions. So I think that diversity is primarily an issue for the highly selective institutions where admission standards tend to be stricter, tend to rely much more on SAT scores, high GPAs, and so forth. So I also think that, I mean, we're talking about racial diversity right now, mm-hmm. but institutions of higher education also look for other forms of diversity, like geographic diversity, as well as your previous guest mentioned, athletes, musicians, and so forth. Diversity, personally, let me just be honest here.
Okay.
I don't think that diversity is necessarily the argument for why we need to use race. I do believe that we have to use race because we have not yet overcome a past of exclusionary practices. And the issues are not only about affirmative action in terms of access, but they're also in terms of equity in educational outcomes at all universities, not just at the University of Texas and University of Michigan or UCLA, but also at the low to medium selectivity institutions. So it's both about access, but we also need to look at equity in educational outcomes. And by that, I mean graduation, retention, and going on to graduate school, entering the high-value occupations, particularly in science, technology, engineering, mathematics.
Ruth Kolker, though, OSU Morehouse College of Law, that you can't say that in court necessarily, though, can you? You have to go abide by the approved definitions.
That's right. Justice Ginsburg, in her dissent, that no one joined. Now, Justice Kagan wasn't allowed to participate, but none of the other liberal members of the court joined Justice Ginsburg. Justice Ginsburg said in dissent, very much something like what we just heard from your guest, she said that we should be considering these kind of issues of equity. We shouldn't be just talking about diversity. And she says, I've always held this view. I will continue to hold this view, but she had to dissent and she's by herself. So we have seven members of the court adopting the diversity language, the race plus other factors language that the court's been using since Bakke in 1978. So this is not a new development.
I think that the issue of equity in access right now, yes, is considered to be illegal. But monitoring student outcomes once they're admitted to a university or a college I don't believe that that would be illegal. And so what I am advocating for, particularly in the work of the Center for Urban Education and the use of the kinds of metrics that we do, mm-hmm. is that institutions of higher education also have a responsibility once they admit students to ensure their success. And even though institutions may be investing a great deal of effort in increasing the diversity of their students, they're not always very good about monitoring their outcome and ensuring what I just said earlier, equity in what happens to them once they're admitted.
I want to get to the idea of monitoring and what you're looking for there, Estella. But first, how do you measure what is sufficient diversity? Does it depend?
I'm probably the worst person to ask that question, but I suppose that, you know, sufficient diversity is more than one.
Uh-huh.
And at least, I would say, five in a classroom.
Okay.
And so I'll leave it at that. I think that the issue is not so much about sufficient diversity.
Uh-huh.
It has to do more, I'm a faculty member, it has to do also with a faculty member and the extent to which that professor is able to recognize, I have that student who is African-American or that student who is Latino, and they're the only one in my class, and how am I relating to that student? So what I would add to this conversation is that a lot of times we focus a great deal on the students that create the diversity for campuses, and we don't focus enough on what institutions, faculty members like myself and others do in order to create an environment that is conducive to the success of the students who are creating diversity.
And is there anything in law that calls for that? Or are all we ever dealing with when it comes to the laws are the kind of superficial admission policies? Ruth Kolker?
Well, we do not have any national law that I can think of that requires universities to take certain steps to guarantee or promote the success of their students. I know the NCAA does a bit with athletes. They monitor how many athletes graduate in 4 years or five mm-hmm. years, that's considered an important measure of success. I certainly know that Ohio State, because I've seen emails about this from the university president, the Ohio State does very much monitor whether all of its students graduate, you know, within 4 or 5 years. We consider that to be a measure of our general success. And obviously to attain general success, you need each subgroup within the campus to attain that success. But so I think that universities themselves understanding that to be a successful university, you need to be graduating students with a degree that they could then use. Obviously, anyone who drops out, it was not probably a very good investment for them or the university for them to have attended. So that's a voluntary program. That's not something that's federally mandated. Certainly the Constitution doesn't mandate that.
Estella Ben-Simon, you developed something called the Equity Success Assessment Program. Can you tell us about that and help how it helps explain diversity on college campuses?
Yes, it's called the Equity Scorecard.
Sorry.
And it really does not concern itself so much with diversity. I developed the Equity Scorecard around 1999-2000, primarily out of a concern that the diversity agenda was leaving behind the original purposes of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which was about equity. So I developed the Equity Scorecard to facilitate for institutions of higher education to be more intentional about monitoring not only access to higher education, but also retention, graduation, as well as other kinds of measures of excellence. What often happens when we talk about diversity and when we talk specifically about minority students, and I mean here African-American, Latinos, American Indians, as well as some of the Pacific Islander populations and Southeast Asians, is that we tend to think of them only in terms of survival, in terms of access, and that it was also important to begin to monitor their proportion, for instance, in the STEM fields, their proportion earning GPAs of 3.5 and higher in order to be able to qualify to go on to graduate school.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially, the equity scorecard is about accountability in equity, and it has been quite successful in terms of its spread to institutions of higher education as well as systems that have adopted it. And the purpose of the equity scorecard essentially was to help institutions to ask the question, you know, how well are we doing with these students? And if we're not, what is it that we are failing at that is not helping the students to be successful? I would also say you asked the question about faculty previously. Is there a legal requirement for institutions of higher education to be responsible for the success of their students? And of course, there isn't. But I do think that institutions of higher education, we are professional organizations. We are in some ways moral institutions. It is our responsibility to do the good for our students.
I guess I was asking that because they're paying money. And when you pay money for something, usually, except for the grade grubbing type of thing going on out there, you're hoping that you'll achieve that goal and that the university or the college or university would help you achieve it. It would be in their vested interest as providing that service.
Yes, I think so. There is often an assumption among higher education practitioners because we have been successful ourselves in higher education. So we assume that when students arrive at our doors, that they come ready, college students, that they know how to do it. And in fact, that's not the case, particularly for the students that we're discussing in regards to affirmative action. Many of them, African-Americans, Latinos, they come from highly segregated, under-resourced high schools where they have not had the advantage of many of their white counterparts, many of whom may be coming from private schools. And so often they come without the college knowledge that you need in order to be successful, from things as simple as knowing that how to go and talk to a faculty member during office hours. And so we make lots of assumptions, and that's where we fail the students, even after they have been admitted. We don't give them the tools always. And by tools, I don't mean the books. I mean the practices of being a good student.
A lot of colleges and universities now have arms of their operation devoted to minority affairs.
Yes, they have many programs. Absolutely, they have all kinds of programs, and they're wonderful programs. There is the TRIO programs, and they provide often a safe haven for these students. But the problem is that they're all on the periphery, and the good things that these programs have done and the skills that their professionals have don't always get integrated into the educational core of the institutions. And my position is that it's not enough to have affirmative action or to have, you know, access, that our institutions of higher education also need to be more intentional about changing themselves to be able to be more inclusive. Our institutions, you know, racism is no longer overtly displayed, but the structures in our institutions of higher education do still have race and gender. And that is the area which we have not really been effective at dismantling, the sort of the systemic racism. And so much of the work that we do with the Equity Scorecard is to facilitate a more honest look at how perhaps through our practices we create inequities.
Who submits themselves? Which universities submit themselves to the scorecard? Are there some examples of the kind of quality that you're talking
absolutely.
About?
Absolutely. And they don't suffer when they submit themselves.
Okay. It's not like the dentist, as we were mentioning.
Okay. Right. They really like it, actually. And they like it because we involve faculty members in the scorecard. And faculty members love to do research, and they love to do inquiry. And the scorecard is all about data, and it's about investigating one's own institution. So the institutions that have used it, and I think you came to me because you read an article about Cornell University. They have been one of the institutions that has used it. Mm-hmm. In addition to Cornell, we are in all of the public institutions of higher education in the Pennsylvania State System of Higher Education, all of the institutions in the University of Wisconsin system. We are also now in Colorado, in Denver institutions. We have been in Nevada, California. And so it's almost about 100 institutions so far. The eagerness of the institutions of higher education want to do better. So the Pennsylvania State System of Higher Education and the University of Wisconsin system invested their own resources in order to implement the scorecard. It's a very structured process. And I should also give here a credit to our funders, the Ford Foundation and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundations. As well as several others that have supported our work. But it's essentially, to put it very simply, the Equity Scorecard is a process that enables teams of faculty and administrators to essentially conduct a very comprehensive investigation of their own institutions using evidence. So it's a very evidence-based process.
Well, Estella Ben-Simon, I want to thank you for joining us today to tell us about it.
All right. Thank you.
Estella Ben-Simon is a professor of education. She studies racial equality in higher education at the University of Southern California. We're going to continue our conversation about diversity in higher education in light of the recent decision by the U.S. Supreme Court in Fisher versus the University of Texas. Coming up, we'll hear from the chief of admissions at Ohio State University. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, children's author Tommy Ungerer. Like his friend Maurice Sendak, Ungerer's work helped change children's books in the 1950s and 60s. But after he began drawing adult erotica, his books were banned from American libraries. Ungerer is the subject of a new documentary called
Far Out Is Not Far Enough.
And that's
one of my sayings.
Join us.
Today at noon on 89.7 NPR News.
Support for 89.7 comes from Green Bean Delivery, offering home delivery of fresh organic produce and natural groceries, striving to make healthy eating more accessible to the communities of Greater Columbus. Details on Green Bean Delivery's products, as well as how to place an order, can be found online at greenbeandelivery.com.
Not too long ago, a tornado devastated Moore, Oklahoma. Community rebuilds for one business owner.
Work-wise, you know, I may be completely out of luck in being able to reopen my office.
I'm David Gura. We go back to Moore 1 month after the storm. Next time on Marketplace from APM.
this afternoon at 6 on 89.7 NPR News. A basic membership for 89.7 NPR News starts at just $60 and comes with our airfare program guide and a grocery tote. Visit WOSU.org.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We are talking about diversity and campus race-based admissions policies in light of the recent U.S. Supreme Court ruling in Fisher versus the University of Texas. In his majority opinion, Justice Anthony Kennedy wrote that courts reviewing affirmative action programs must show that race is necessary to achieve the educational benefits of diversity. Joining us now to talk about that, what that means in Ohio and specifically to Ohio State University is Vern Granger. He's chief of admissions at OSU. He joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Ann.
OSU Interim President Joseph Aluto issued a statement last week expressing pleasure with the court's ruling to uphold affirmative action in admissions. The caveat was to do so with strict scrutiny. What does that mean to OSU?
Well, what it means to us is that we're always mindful of the Grutter case, and we want to make sure that our policy is in line with that. So every year we will meet with not only members of our staff, but representatives throughout the campus to talk about our admissions process, again, to make sure that we are compliant with the rulings of Grutter.
I was just talking with Estella Bensimon of the University of Southern California, where she studies racial equality, and they have a equity scorecard, she called it, that they use, and that it has something to do with admissions, but it also has to do with retention and achievement, mm-hmm. and making sure that the diversity is in all of those elements as well.
Absolutely. First things that we do when we review any applicant is that we want to ensure that the student can be academically successful at the university. And I think we've done a very, very good job at that at Ohio State University. We have all-time graduation highs, graduation rates in 82%. Annually, we retain 92% of our incoming freshmen to the sophomore year. So I think we do a very, very good job of ensuring that the students who we admit to the university are going to be able to complete their degree at Ohio State University.
There's that freshman experience that OSU instituted a few years ago.
Yeah.
To what extent does that experience and that program penetrate the issues of affirmative action, penetrate the issues of race and other diversity?
Sure. At Ohio State University, we really view that first year as very, very important. And in fact, I would say that to us, the first-year experience is not only an ethos, but there's an actual office on campus, because we understand that if students get off to a great start, they lay down that wonderful foundation, they're going to be much more successful at the university. But we also have an office that works 10 full-time staff members, a number of students who will work with students, again, throughout that first year. And we think it's important that students are able to get connected. I'm connected to their academic programs and connected to resources, connected to friends, all of those things. And we think that that does a great job of ensuring student success, not only that freshman year, but beyond.
My guest, Vern Granger, he's chief of admissions at OSU. Also with us, Ruth Kolker, professor and constitutional law expert at the OSU Moritz College of Law. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Maybe you are a minority at Ohio State University. Give us a call and tell us about your experience. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. In February, the Columbus Dispatch reported that although minority admissions are up at the regional campuses, they are down at the main campus. And OSU trustee Algernon Marbley, a U.S. district judge, said at the time that he found that drop-off to be disturbing.
Well, at Ohio State University, we want to make sure that we are enrolling as diverse a class as possible. Diversity is extremely important to the university. It, in fact, is one of our strategic pillars. And it's going to allow for students to get that well-rounded experience, what we find is that diversity allows students to bring those different perspectives. It's going to allow students, it's going to challenge their own beliefs and allow them to have those dialogues with other students. So we absolutely value the importance of diversity. And we think that as a flagship institution like Ohio State, we have a responsibility to ensure that we are graduating leaders, not only in the state of Ohio, but who are going to go on nationally and internationally to do that, do wonderful work. So it's something that we're always conscious of in our recruitment and in our retention and our enrollment, is to try to ensure that we are enrolling and helping that cohort of students who are admitted be successful at the university.
How much of that drop-off do you attribute to the higher entrance, the more exclusive entrance qualifications, the top 10% of your high school class, the
sure.
GPA, the SAT scores, and so forth?
Sure. Well, there's no doubt that that had an impact on it. And in fact, if you looked at other selective institutions throughout the state, in the aftermath of the Grutter, there were reductions, there were drops in the enrollment of minority students at their universities as well. So mm-hmm. it's something that we're very, very conscious of. We've implemented and are implementing a number of strategies towards, again, trying to attract and enroll a diverse student body. And for example, in the middle of July, we plan on opening a Cleveland Recruitment and Access Center that will work specifically with students from the Cleveland Public Schools, as well as students throughout the Cleveland area, the community colleges, Cuyahoga Community College as well, to, again, attract students to our university. But I think most importantly, what this center is going to be is it's going to give Ohio State a presence where we're going to be working with students to help them get the skills that's needed, not only to get entrance into Ohio State, but to go to college in general. We value the role that education plays in ensuring students can be successful in life. And so we plan on the center being able to perform a number of those different functions. So we're very excited about that. But that's just one example of the strategies that we have and are planning to implement to try to enroll a more diverse student body at our university.
Again, Estella Ben-Simon from USC was talking about the comfort level of students and how a lot depends on how comfortable they feel. And Columbus City Schools, I don't know if they still do it, but they did have a program where if you reached a certain level of attendance and grade success by the sixth grade, you got to go to OSU for the day. You got to go see a baseball game or something like that, and there was a big rally and so on. And when they asked how many kids in the audience, and there were hundreds of kids up in the stands, had ever been on the OSU campus, just a few raised their mm-hmm. arms. And I was wondering how, when you talk about that Cleveland Recruitment and Access Center, how young are you going? How deep are you going?
We plan on working with students as far down as middle school because, you know, setting that foundation, getting them to think about college as a possibility is going to make a huge difference. And so that's one of the main roles that's going to be played by this Cleveland Center. And again, working with community leaders in Cleveland, working with the mayor's office in Cleveland, we think that this center is going to really, really give Ohio State a significant presence in the Cleveland area. And if this is successful, it's something that we could replicate in other areas throughout the state.
Will there be any sort of reevaluation of the current process based on the Fisher ruling?
Well, with or without the current Fisher ruling, it's something that we do every year in our office. Again, we will assemble members of our admission staff, but we'll also work with our legal counsel's office. We'll work with our data analysis office, our scholarships and financial aid office, to make sure that our process is fair and that it's transparent, and that we're achieving our ultimate goal, and that is to enroll the most qualified and diverse student body possible. And we think that's a very, very important goal, and we want to ensure that our process is compliant to the Grutter case, and it's something that we will do every year. So regardless of what the decision was, that's something that's that we have done for a number of years already.
Are you looking at the grade, the GPA and so forth of the student body to determine whether enough of that diversity is moving forward into the Fisher School of Business, into the Moritz College of Law, mm-hmm. into those, you know, higher education destinations?
Sure. Well, our process, the heart of our admissions process is our holistic review of applications. And basically what that means is that we're going to be looking at a number of quantitative factors, grades, students' class rank, the school that they go to, the curriculum that they're enrolled in, test scores. All those things will be a part of our quantitative review, but there's also those qualitative reviews as well. And so we will, on a limited basis, look at different types of diversity, whether it be ethnic, racial, but also geographic, also academic diversity. We believe diversity in all forms is very, very important. And so that's going to be the heart of our application review process. The grades, the test scores, those are going to be the primary factors because, again, we want to make sure that the first thing and the question that's asked in our review process is, do we feel the student can be academically successful at the university? And if that answer is yes, then, again, we will start looking at those issues of diversity to try to ensure that we have academic program diversity and racial, ethnic diversity and all the other types of diversity I mentioned.
Applications are all online now, right?
Yes.
How much does that help get through a lot of this process? Because how many applications do you get a year?
This year we got close to 36,000 applications for consideration. So you're absolutely right. And the number of applications that we receive is a large number, and it continues to increase. And I think the ease of completing the application online is something that's a great benefit to the students, and it also helps in our process because the information is fed directly in our system, and our staff does not have to manually enter applications as they did once upon a time when electronic applications were not available.
Ruth Kolker, getting back to you, as far as what universities are doing out there, when we're listening to Vern Granger describe their processes, the things that they're doing, giving us examples, is this the sort of stuff that they would have to bring to court with them if anybody challenges them on their policies?
Oh, absolutely. When you read the University of Michigan decision, which was based after a trial, you read about testimony that's in very specific detail about, for example, and this is really important to whether their plan was constitutional, when you're making, let's say, the last 10 decisions, and you've admitted to a law school class 200, you have 10 spots left. Law schools will be very careful. They want to maintain a certain overall GPA and LSAT score for ranking purposes. What the University of Michigan decision tells us is you can't say, oh, we're at 4.3% blacks. We want 4.5% black. We're going to take this applicant only because he's African American. You're not allowed to, at that point, essentialize someone and only make them their race. You have to always, the court tells us, treat the person as an individual in their holistic sense. This person's a basketball player. This person's a musician. This person had a high class rank. And in addition, this person happens to be black. You can think of them in that way. But the court is very clear, especially with Justice Kennedy's decision in Fisher and his dissent in Grutter, that you have to treat the person as a whole individual and not essentialize them and make them only their race. And I think that's what we're hearing from OSU. How do they do that with 36,000 applications? Mm-hmm. It's much easier to do at a law school when you're dealing with maybe several thousand applications. But I can't imagine what it would mean to look at 36,000 applications and treat each person as an individual, not as a number, not as a race.
Yeah, Vern Granger, no pressure, but how do you do that? And is this a huge university? I feel like a number and I work here.
I mean, it's not an easy chore, but we employ a large number of full-time staff members, and we hire part-time readers to go through all of these applications. So you're right. It is something that, you know, it is time-consuming. It's very labor-intensive. But, again, we feel it's a very, very important task to undertake because, again, all the values and all everything that diversity brings. And so you're right, we're going through those applications. We start reviewing applications in September, and we will be, you know, looking at applications all throughout the winter and into the spring to again make sure that we are taking all the things that Ruth mentioned earlier. I mean, it's we need to make sure that our policy is in line with the things that were set forth in Grutter. And I think by looking at those quantitative factors that I talked about earlier, but also taking into other factors into consideration to support the academic review of an application, I think for us, it we're very, very comfortable with our process, and we think that it's in line with a number of other selective institutions like Ohio State throughout the country.
The regional campuses are becoming more and more accepted. I know there's still people who gripe about their kids going there. They didn't make the cut into the main campus. I was wondering, a lot of students go there. They want to go there. They want the smaller classes. They want the lower tuition rates and to be able to get an Ohio State University degree at the same time. Are you at all culling from those ranks to make sure that people aren't slipping through the cracks into the regional campuses and do belong on the main campus and should be there? They qualify, and they could also help you achieve your goals of diversity.
Well, we feel that the regional campuses are a part of that one university mantra that we really talk about, the university. And we work with advisors and students at the regional campus to ensure that there are pathways set up, that if they do choose to come to the main campus, that those pathways are set up. But as you mentioned, the regional campuses give students that Ohio State education, and so a number of students will choose to stay at those institutions and get their degrees, and we think that that's perfectly fine. They are a part of Ohio State University, mm-hmm. And so students, well, some may choose to come to Columbus, and that's fine, but then others may choose to stay at the regional campus, and that's also fine.
How much does the diversity issue affect your outreach to students?
Well, we're constantly doing all different forms of recruitment, mm-hmm. In order to recruit a diverse student body. You know, that could be first-generation recruitment, students from low socioeconomic backgrounds, geographic diversity, academic diversity. So it plays a big part in our recruitment process.
Okay.
We're not only a state university and a flagship state university. We feel that we're a national university as well. And so we are recruiting all over the country in order to expand the pool of students who we're able to consider for admissions at the Ohio State University.
Vern Granger, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Vern Granger, he's the chief of admissions at Ohio State University. Also, Ruth Kolker, professor and constitutional law expert at OSU Moritz College of Law. Ruth, thanks for joining us again.
My pleasure. Thank you, Ann.
And thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.